Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Creasy! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And good morning once again. This is Coach Chuck Creasy. I'm back with another edition of American Tennis. We remind you every week with American Tennis that our mission stays the same. We need you and everyone to stand up and speak out and to try to right this ship that we call USA Tennis, and why are we underachieving, and why are we not getting further down the road, and why are we not in a dominant position that we were several years ago. And we want you to stand up and to speak out. All of us have some skin in the game here. Everybody that's interested in tennis, we've got to do our part with our circle of influence, those people that are immediately around us. You know, our circle of concern is really big, but really it's that youngster that's right in front of us, that's that coach that we need to talk things over with, and those players, those competitive players, we need to step up and speak to the king or the queen and these young boys and girls and try to get them to stretch themselves as well. Reminded Edmund Burke's quote every week that all that it takes for evil to prosper is for good men or good people to do nothing. We all have a duty to stand up and speak out. This is the UR Tennis Network. If you want to call in today, it's area code 714-583-6853. That's 714-583-6853. My website is chuckcreasy.net. You can go there and find out about my T3 mentorship programs and my total tennis training camps that I've done for 38 years. And we're getting ready for camp season, actually, so please, if you know a youngster who wants to go to a great camp, we've had over 14,000 children through our camps in the South Carolina and Atlanta area. It's a good way to get in shape for the summer tournaments. And, folks, today we have on with us the great David Goetz. And I think Dave's on the line. I can hear you, Dave. You on the line?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, Chuck?
Yeah, you're good, Dave. Listen, folks, Dave's actually on the way to a tournament. You're going up to where, Philadelphia there to recruit at the grass courts, Dave?
Yep, the International Grass Court Tournament is being played in Philly right now. So I'm on my way over there. So if you hear the GPS lady talking to me, I hope that's all right, Chuck.
Yeah, but man, you've been up in that town for 2 years. Come on, Dave. I mean, you ought to know your way around. Are you? Have you been GPS'd with your life? I mean, we're all getting GPS'd with our lives here. Come on, man. You needed a GPS to get you around town there?
I, you know what? I hang out in the city, and the Marion Cricket Club's a little outside my realm. And so I got to admit, I'd never been there.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a little concerned about this whole GPS thing because, you know, I used to take pride in being able to use a Texaco or a Sunoco map to get anywhere there is, and now we all seem to have to use a GPS. And I've got an analogy with tennis coaching to throw in there in a little bit, but let's talk about you, Dave. Dave, you've got a great story, and by the time the people hear this, they'll will be more impressed than anything. I think anybody that knows Dave Getz knows that he's just a wonderful and a good human being. He's a good and noble man, and he works hard every day, and he's done just about everything in the realm of coaching tennis. Dave, you know, came up, I'm going to get you to talk about this too, Dave, but Dave came up in North Dakota, and I can only think of one other kid who came from South Dakota, North Dakota, that made the Kalamazoo and was a junior at Kalamazoo. That was a kid who went to Notre Dame a few years back, Dave. I don't know. I forget what the young man's name was, but you got good in North Dakota. You were a hockey player. And, you know, anybody that ever played against you knew that you were a very physical player and just a tremendous athlete. I think you could have played a tight end. You could have been a shortstop. You could have done a lot of things. Great hand-eye coordination, great athleticism. But you worked your way through the ranks somehow, and then you got a scholarship down to New Mexico. And of all places, you went on down to New Mexico, Dave. And then I want you to tell the whole story, though, but about how you got to the NCAA tournament here in a minute. But it's a good story. People need to hear this whole story. And then after New Mexico, Dave, you went up to Minnesota where you basically, for about a 15-year period, dominated the Big Ten in the state of with Minnesota tennis. I think 7 Big Ten titles, several Coach of the Year awards, and just a great job there. And then you got out of it, and correct me, went to Hong Kong and for a while. That had to have been interesting. You went from Minnesota to Hong Kong. How long did you stay over there, Dave?
I was there a year. That was a great experience. I actually learned a lot in Hong Kong because I saw the guys from the Philippines that were coming over there to teach lessons. The first month, I hated it. Because I went out there, and what I did was I got there at 6:30 in the morning. I'd teach straight till noon. I'd have a half hour, 15-minute lunch. Then I would get up and teach straight till 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And the next day, I'd get up and do it again. And I did it 6 days a week, and it was the toughest thing I ever did. It was subtropical temperate climate. It was hot and muggy, and it was really, really tough. I did it, and I kind of learned a little bit better work ethic. The Filipino guys would come over, and they would teach at a public park, and they'd get there at 6 in the morning, and they would teach straight through till the lights went out at 12 o'clock at night. And I thought, and the old guys were happy for the opportunity to do it, because there's no prospects in the Philippines. And I thought, wow, these guys are some of the hardest working guys I've ever seen. And I'd kick myself in the rear and say, why am I whining about teaching 8 or 9 hours a day? These guys are out there doing it every single day. And I basically felt that I just got soft and I got spoiled, and it was really hard for me the first month.
Well, you're one of the toughest American guys we had, Dave. I mean, and you're talking about getting soft and getting spoiled. I know it was the same for my wife and my family when I went over to Thailand, but, you know, we whined for about 3-4 months until we met some missionary families over there that were doing it for their livelihood and for their life, basically, and they've been to all these places, and we just, my golly, how soft are we? And I think that, you know, you make a good point there. We want to talk about how we're soft. Hey, we came back, and I think you said about a year as an assistant at Ohio State just to get back into it, and then you were at Cornell. You went to the Ivy Leagues, coached at Cornell. I mean, and then you I think you won one Ivy and were runner-up at one, but then for whatever reason, You had to leave Cornell. You went up to a big club in Connecticut, and then University of Pennsylvania lassoed you and brought you back there. So, I mean, folks, we've got Dave Goetz on here today, and he's going to be able to talk from many, many different perspectives that he has had in his coaching. And, you know, we want to try to solve this thing, Dave. I've been talking about the power leaks in American tennis and why we're not quite getting it done. We'll be right back with American Tennis here.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Anybody was made in America, it was Coach David Goetz. Coach Goetz, you grew up in North Dakota. Come on, man. You talked a little bit about getting good in North Dakota. What were your challengers, man? But what might have been unique that helped you about it?
Well, the challenges in North Dakota was when I grew up, you could only play maybe 5 months of the year. I grew up about 40 miles from the Canadian border. And you could only play 5 months of the year outside, maybe. And there wasn't an indoor court to play on. And you just couldn't play in the wintertime. That, and there was a little bit of a serious lack of competition and zero coaching that was available to you. So I think in North Dakota, when I grew up, it may have been the worst place possible to try and develop a tennis player. But the first time I hit a tennis ball, I loved it. And for me, it was the game I wanted to play. And I look back, you know what, if I was going to pick a sport that I could have excelled at, tennis would have, was probably the last one. And so, but that's one I love. So I went for it, but it was the...
How'd you get into tennis? So, I mean, what was the, it wasn't a program or a system, was it? How'd you get into it?
I played, I took a junior high school tennis class and, the instructor knew probably zero about tennis. He made us hit a few balls on the wall, and I kind of liked it. My buddies and I, well, now we're screwing around. We started playing each other, and we play a little bit, and then pretty soon whoever was losing a fight would break out and played a little bit more. And we just started playing all the time. And it was a junior high class. Plus, I wouldn't go to hockey camp in the summertime, and it was a nice excuse not to do that. And I love the individual part of it. It's great. It's all up to you. You know that. It's nobody else. It's you. And your teammates can't blame you. Your dad can't blame you if you lost. If you lost, it was all you, Chuck. So I love that part of it.
Well, you were a self-starter, and you were a self-coached, and you've done so many things that are unique during your career. But the biggest thing I think we want to hit upon here is that we've got all these systems out here, Dave. And, again, I've been hitting on the power leaks in American tennis week after week, trying to figure out exactly and trying to give people insight that it is not a system. It basically, the USTA should be giving incentives to people and telling them, there's the bar, get over the bar, and figure it out on your own some. Because I told the kids yesterday, I'm down here in Florida right now, we've got about five young kids that are, juniors in high school trying to play in these futures. And I told them, I said, guys, hard to pick up is hard to put down. Easy to pick up is easy to put down. If you do more on your own, you will not give it away easily. And then we had the benefit of having Mitchell Frank here helping some of the young kids. And he gave the kids a talk yesterday just basically, and he's in, University of Virginia now, Dave. But he said, look, yep, guys, if you work really, really hard, when you do have success, you will embrace it. You won't just throw it away. You'll own it. If you don't work hard and you just live off of your talent and have some good results, you'll easily give them away. But, all right, talk about how you went to the University of New Mexico. Did a coach see you play somewhere, or how did you get a scholarship down there?
No, he never saw me play. There was a kid from Florida that was supposed to show up on campus, and the kid just did not show up. All of a sudden, it's a week into school. School starting. It's been going on for a week. And the guy short a guy, and he had a full scholarship, and he called me out of the blue. He said, I called you out of the blue because I saw you won the state men's tournament. I figured there's no good tennis in North Dakota, but maybe if you won the men's tournament, there must be one good guy, so I'm going to give you a scholarship. And he gave me a scholarship to go. And I told him, I didn't have any money. He gave me a full ride. So I showed up at the airport, and the coach picked me up at the airport, got me in classes, and that's how I went there. They were the only school that I could play. My criteria for going to college was, let me find a school that will give me a full ride or a scholarship that's far enough down south I can play every single day of the year outside. And that was the only school that really recruited me. So, yeah, so it was great for me. Got to play every day outside, and I had three guys that were a lot better than me, and they all got hurt. One guy redshirted, so I ended up playing number one as a freshman, and got thrashed for a whole year, but it helped me a lot.
Dave, that's an incredible story. I mean, it really is, but it's not unlike a lot of them that we used to hear 20, 30 years ago. It seems now that we've got recruiting services, and, I think a lot of the stuff is good, but we've got so many computers that can pinpoint exactly where your progress is, exactly what you need to do to get better, exactly who you need to beat. And the mystery of sort of not knowing things, isn't that important, just the mystery of saying, hey, maybe I'm getting thrashed here, but maybe, just maybe, I can turn the corner here.
So, see, you're the one guy that I always think everybody's looking for the secret, or what's a great drill, or what's the process to get better. But I think you're the one guy that just kind of figured it out really, really early. And you know what? I used to put up all the pictures of players in my garage that were better than me. I used to come out in the middle of the winter and jump rope and look at all the guys and think, I want to beat that guy. And I would kind of see what they're doing, but you always figure it out early. You know what? If I want to beat Chuck Creasy, and I know Chuck Creasy practices 2 hours a day, and I go practice 4 hours a day, the cumulative effect of those couple of extra hours over a long period of time is going to be huge, and I'm going to beat you pretty soon. And Jay Berger said this too, there's not really a secret. Come on, just work harder than the other guy. That's the secret. That's what you did at Clemson. I was a guy that spent a long time looking for the secret, and I was also one of the knuckleheads. I read every single one of those books about talent, The Outliers, Bounce by Matthew Saeed, From Mozart to Federer, How Genius is Created, Talent is Overrated. I read every single one of them. and they all basically kind of say the same thing. Don't they all say 10,000 hours of purposeful practice? So then you got to look, okay, so how do I make my practice purposeful? Well, you know what? A lot of them say you practice slow, so you build the myelin sheet that you need, but you also practice fast. You practice at a pace that doesn't happen in a match. It's so much faster and it's so much quicker that match time seems slow. It's the same reason why boxers, when they train for a 12-round fight, they spar like they spar 40 rounds. I mean, they will overtrain because you can't replicate that nervous energy. But you figured it out from the very start. Let's just work harder than anybody else. That's the biggest secret to success there is.
Well, your hockey background had to have helped you a lot. I mean, you continue to improve a lot. You know, at the University of New Mexico, you climbed up the steps there, and you made the NCAA tournament. Your junior and your senior year, or just your senior year?
No, I qualified my junior year, and I was really excited, and I started looking at the bottom of the draw. I made it to the NCAAs. I look at the bottom. I'm going all the way up, and I can't find my name. I get near the top, and I think, oh, my God, they forgot to put me in. And I drove myself. I drove down there to play, and they didn't put me in. Also, I get to the next line to the top.
Yeah,
I played Kevin Kern, the number one seed, first round.
You drove from New Mexico to Athens, Georgia?
I drove from New Mexico to Athens, Georgia, 1 year. The other year, I flew.
Oh, God, love it,
but,
man.
You know, my coach in 2 years didn't go with me. In fact, I was looking, and I had a pretty good year, and I thought they took four players out of each region, and I'd beaten three of the guys. I thought I was the best player in our region that year. But I wasn't, I asked my coach, well, you know, can I go to the NCAA tournament? So, I don't know, here's the paperwork. You can fill it out, turn in your results. So I took all the paperwork, filled it all in myself. I sent it to every person on the regional chair, and I got in the NCAA tournament. But my coach was a great guy, and he's a good friend of mine, but he kind of moved on in that aspect of his life. So I filled out all the paperwork, and I got myself in. I drove myself there.
You know, Getz, as you're talking here, the thought comes to my head. One of the power leaks that we have in the U.S. is that we keep score too much. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not saying that we keep scoring our sets or matches, but we use the computer to figure out too much where we're at. In other words, you know, it's the greatest bankruptcy in the world is to see a youngster under 18, 19, 20 years old that sort of their dreams turn into just these reality goals because they figured out how hard it is. It's just like there's too much information out there that they can find. They find out who a player's beat, what they're ranked. They know so many things that really there's no mystery, and it takes away from the hope and the dreams and the bottom line, the gut. The gut desire of an athlete. I always had a belief in coaching that opportunities are important. It's important to give an opportunity to a player, but you better not give it to them before they're ready to it or hungry for it, because if they don't use it, a lot of times they'll throw the thing away. So, you know, my saying always, Getz, was that as a coach, I kept fog on top of the mountain until the kids are too high up to turn back. I never, ever let them know how hard things were at the onset. I mean, think of the toughest things you've ever done. If you'd have known enough, you'd have never made that drive from New Mexico to Athens. And then if you'd known enough, you probably wouldn't have done many, many of the hard things that you've had to do in your life. And that's why I think a lot of the kids are being dumbed down with computers. Your thoughts?
Sure. They say the computer is a thief of time. How many times have you sat down at the computer and it's an hour and a half later? It's went by like that. A totally unproductive time. I had a question for you. I mean, I go down to College Park and I watch how you train your kids, and I saw the results that you put on the board at Clemson. And so it's obvious to me that you knew the secret. Let's outwork somebody. Let's outwork every team in the country, and let's be the best conditioned team. So you knew that, and you also know how to run a practice and get the most out of kids. But what I want you to tell me is I want to know the secret for making the kids so motivated that they'll do it if you don't show up for practice. How do you do that? that. Because if you could do that, and especially if you could do it in the Ivy League, you'd have it.
Dave, you know, that's the where you have to go to eventually as a coach. You have to turn over ownership to the players. You've got to get them to where they're like Mitchell Frank. And but the thing is, a lot of that people will say, well, they're born that way. But I really believe it's at first it's compliance. The kids are compliant. They have to turn compliance to commitment. And I'll tell you, I would rather have a kid that's committed and not compliant. I'd rather have a rebel any day of the week that can light it up in fights when it's on the table than somebody that's compliant and just doing everything right all the time but then doesn't make a commitment. So you go from compliance to commitment to in being inspired really to a place. There's a term out there called reticular activation. And it's, you know, this old guy, that Anthony Robbins guy that used to be on late night and stuff. He used to talk about this all the time. But he talked about RAS, reticular activation system. But it's basically when it becomes the most important thing in your life or an extremely important thing, you will figure out how to be successful with it. Now, to answer your quick question about what happens a lot of times when kids get to college, I think up there in the Ivies, you've got a problem in that your kids to have the natural bailout. They can say, well, you know, I'm into my academics now. I'm getting on with my real life. And tennis is nice, and I'll try my best, and we're having a good team experience. But basically, they lose their motivation. Vesaponka, who I worked with there, you know, I've just left College Park. We're back down in South Carolina. But I'm going to be traveling some with all the kids. I'll be going up there for 6 weeks this next year. Vesa is the most noble man and just a good, good man and leader. But he said really, really well. He said where we're messing up is we lose the kids between ages 15, 16, 17. They start looking at college, Dave, as the end goal. You know, you and I, and back before computers, we were too stupid to know how hard things were, I think. And, you know, the kids now, they size it up. Then they get to go to college, and they basically start putting on the brakes when they're 15 or 16. So Vesa said you ought to take a team out. Like we've got down here, we've got five kids that we're traveling with, the three futures. And, by the way, they went in three or four matches in the qualifying, but, by golly, we're up at 6 o'clock every morning going to train, and they're trying to become pros with that just happened to be, they're trying to act like pros in 16, 17-year-old bodies and do the right things. So, I mean, that's the answer there, Dave. You've got to get to the place where it becomes the most important thing. You know, so, you know, I got a quick one here. The people want to hear you speak, but Tanya, who actually just took the assistant coaching job at South Carolina the other day. And Ryan Young was traveling over in Turkey, and he said, oh, it was Uzbekistan. He and a guy named Nathan Thompson were living in the back of a filling station, and he had just a sort of a cot to sleep on. There was nothing to do. They walked through the courts every day. They ate tuna every meal. They're basically out of money. You know what he said? He got to the qualified and then got to the finals of the 15,000 there. He goes, when tennis becomes the most important thing you do during the day, you get a lot better at it. And I think that in itself is what we have done. The kids just, you know, they've got other things that they go to, Dave. So what's your thoughts, man?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I like the way you said it. You know, the harder you work, the harder it is to surrender.
That's a Johnny Wooden quote, you know, from They Call Me Coach. It's one of the first books I ever read when I started coaching back in 75 at Clemson. The harder I work, the harder it is to surrender. The more you sweat in peacetime, the less you'll bleed in war. You know, basically, the more you invest, and Mitchell said it to the kids the other night. It is beautiful. He said, guys, if you don't work hard, then you'll get some successes just on your talent. But when you get it on just your talent, you will easily discard it. Sort of like a gift that's given to you that is not sort of meaningless, or it's money that's given to you instead of money earned. You know, so the earned part of it is the big part, Dave Guest. So All right, Dave Getz, talk about, you went over to the NCAAs your senior year then too, but then they made you the coach at New Mexico.
Yeah, that was, you know, my NCAA senior year trip was really, it was a great experience because I was flying over in the airport. I was sitting next to a guy, and we just started talking, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to play the NCAA tournament. And he says, oh, great. He says, oh, where's your coach? And I said, oh, my coach isn't here. He's not coming along. I'm just going to go play. And I pick up a rental car or shuttle. And he said, hey, I'll be your coach. And it was Greg Patton, who was at Boise State, who went out of his way to come over and say, hey, I'll help you through your, you know, I think I wasn't all that good. I won one match in 2 years at the NCAA. The first year I lost to the number one seed, Kevin Kern, who won the tournament without losing a set. And the next year I lost a close match in the Duke of Otis by the second round. So I won one match in 2 years, and Pat was my coach. And I'll never forget the guy for going out of his way for no money, nothing at all, no reason to help at all, and just decided to do it. So that was my NCAA senior experience. And I really appreciate the fact that I'm not listening anywhere.
Well, when it becomes important enough, you find every little thing that will help you make the steps. And the hunger, you know, I tell you, there is no cure for lazy. When a youngster is lazy, if they're not hungry when they're young and they live off their talent, it's tough to kick in the hard work ethic afterwards. And now it's just too tough. So players really do size things up. Dave, I've got to go to commercial here. When we come back, I've been talking about the power leaks in American tennis each and every week. I'm very frustrated. I bet you are as well. But we got to talk about what's going on in college tennis, man. They made some new deals here where they're just butchering the scoring system again. After 10,000 names were signed last summer, they came back and morphed this thing. And they're just butchering it for them. I don't know how it could be good at all for developing players. We'll be right back. American Tennis.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At USSportCamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit USSportCamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.USSportCamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
And this is Coach Chuck Creasy back with American Tennis. We have today as a guest Coach David Getz, and Dave, I'm inspired by everything that happened to you. I just wish, I think you were young enough, probably, or I was coaching when you played, so I wish the heck I would have been able to coach you. You're exactly what I used to look like when I looked for, as far as an athlete and the kind of person when I started coaching. Your story is a great one. You know, I don't know if players could pull this off these days. I don't know if the independence of players or if they're too, we escort too many kids to the front of the line when they start winning, too many trophies. Dave, we've got all kinds of power leaks. Before I go into talk about those, what are the power leaks as far as you're concerned? Why we're underachieving in American tennis?
Well, it almost seems, I think you touched on it a little bit, it almost seems like the more you do for somebody, the less they can do for themselves, and the more dependent that they come. And so if you could foster that independence, isn't that's what made a lot of great players. If you can foster the independence and teach a kid to do some stuff for himself, I think it actually might have been you that told me everything you do for, that you do for yourself is worth four times what somebody else has done for you. And the motivation, Chuck, to be, you need motivation to be great. You absolutely have to. And the motivation is weird, I think. All the studies say, you know, you should say four positive comments for every negative comment. You want to inspire. And I don't know, there's many ways to motivate. I saw Tucker motivate people at Ohio State. When I talked about me not being tough when I went over to Hong Kong, Tucker was tough at Ohio State. And the kids play hard and they practice hard. And maybe it's out of fear, but Tucker's able to get that out of them. And so I have a lot of respect for that whole program, because that program works hard. So how do you motivate kids? I mean, the greatest single motivator for me, which made me get out and want to do it, was I hope my dad's not listening, but, I mean, he'd always tell me I was worthless. You know, worthless, good for nothing, son of a bitch, never going to amount to anything, blah, blah, blah. I heard all the time. So I don't think I heard a positive comment ever. And in the back of my mind, I kind of tuned it out, but I kind of thought, yeah, you know what? You have no idea, and it kind of inspired me a little bit. So I think the old man was absolutely a master motivator for me, if that's what he was trying to do. And so I had a chip on my shoulder and something to try and prove. And I think actually tennis-wise, it sounds bragging. I think I did everything I possibly could. I practiced as hard as I could possibly practice. I just didn't have maybe enough God-given talent to really be a great tennis player, but I gave it everything I had. I could promise that. I don't have any regrets looking back. So the motivation is the key. And I mean, you've always been great with motivating players. How can you get the kid to motivate himself? Then you'd really have something, Chuck, if you'd have Mitchell Frank.
Yeah, that's the trick, and I do know that there are things as they come up, you have got to do the right things when they're successful, the right things when they're not successful. You've got to stay on them constantly. You've got to continue to believe in them, but believing in them does not mean babying them. We do make too many hothouse flowers. We provide the perfect environment. We provide the perfect practices. We try to provide perfect uniforms, facilities, coaching, and all these things, the systems, but that's not what makes it. You basically need to, the player needs to get be able to get down and dirty on their own and figure out. And I do know, I really, really believe this after all these years, the great players hate losing more than other players. They hate losing, and they can even be afraid of losing. And I saw this quote recently where great players are afraid of losing and hate it, and everyone else is secretly afraid of winning because of responsibility that it comes along. And the minute you start winning, of course, or the minute you start making straight A's on your report card, or the minute you start doing well in business, it's sort of like you've got to do it again. And secretly, a lot of kids sort of cash into a pecking order, and they just hang out there, and that's why we're not having the movement. Dave, I got to talk about the quick power leaks here. I want you to talk about college tennis a little bit. Dave, we have 350,000 kids that are playing high school tennis, and less than 8% of them play five tournaments per year. That's disgraceful. So what happens is it's basically a social situation, high school tennis teams, in many of the situations. Now, Texas has a great system. The kids play team in the fall, then they play individual tournaments all spring, and everybody raves about how good the Texas system is. But I think the high school system is a sleeping giant. Dave, think about this one. 72% of all pro athletes come from rural, not urban communities, rural communities. And think of the waste that we are doing and just pushing urban, and you know, that's fine. You can have those programs, but we really drop the ball when we also put in the point system. The USTA puts in a point system that awards points to certain tournaments. They pick the winners and they pick the losers, Dave. It wasn't like, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it wasn't like in the old days where you could go to the Cracker Land at Athens, Georgia, and you knew that eight players, great players from around the South would be there. And in this. Right now what happens, USTA picks tournaments that they endow, and then the kids have to go chase the points. So what happens, we had a fellow on last week from South Georgia. If you're from South Georgia, 5-hour drive from Atlanta, and you want to run a big tournament, it doesn't matter if you have the great initiative to make things happen at the grassroots level. If you become a 4A or a 5A tournament, nobody comes. And so it really, really, we're killing our rural tennis, Dave, and this is something we really, really need to get after. The biggest culprit, and I wanted to go from here, and then you can comment on all of them, but Dave, it's been 20 years since we had a female USA girl that went to college and ended up in the top 100 in the WTA. 20 years, Lisa Raymond. We have a girl named Falcone now that went to Georgia Tech that has stepped up, I think, about 80 in the world. But the first time in 20 years, if that's not an indictment on how crummy the developmental part of college tennis is for women, I don't know what. And in 1982, David, in the men's side, we had 39 players that had gone to college and made the top 100 ATP men. 39. David, we only have one right now, John Isner. One. I mean, that's disgusting. It's the worst thing I've ever heard. I mean, how in the world can we have these great coaches, these great facilities, all the opportunities we give these kids, and it's not a stepping stone anymore? What do you think? I have lost David Getz here. I'm hoping that he will call back here. All right, David, if you can hear, come on, call on back. I want to get your feelings on this. I go through these statistics every week, because I want people out there to be aware of what in the world is going on, because we are not doing a good enough job. And I think I got Dave Getz back on the line. Dave Getz?
I missed you. I thought before you wanted me to comment a little bit about college, but I tell you, the college system is tremendously flawed. How do you motivate people when you can say the kid really wants to play? Oh, sorry, we can only play 20 hours a week. I can't hit with you. I mean, how does that motivate anybody? The kid wants to go play an extra tournament. Oh, sorry, you're limited to 25 matches, match competitions a year. I mean, there's so many limitations that were never, ever in place when you and I first started. How do you outwork anybody under those circumstances? How do you inspire the kids to do more? It's really, I think, so now the trick to produce better players is try and find a way to max every day that you have on the court. You can't waste a minute of practice time. Your time schedule has to be much tighter and more productive. You've got to get more done in less time. That's what you have to do to succeed at the college level.
Dave, there's two things I wanted to comment on here. First of all, you can't get people good when you've got a time limit or a clock on everything. And I've brought this up a few times on the show, that you know that it's a fact that Thomas Edison never had a clock or a stopwatch or a watch in his laboratory. You tell me why you think that would be so. Why do you think? What is your belief?
It done. Maybe for the same reason that he just wants to stay there until he got it done.
You got it done. Exactly. Dave, when you have a clock on everything, you just said it. You've got to be so exact. As coaches, we're running around like chickens with our head cut off, trying to, okay, we've got to get to 15 minutes of stretching. Oh, my God, we just wasted another 5 minutes. Come on, guys, get it together here. And then we got to go, okay, we've got to get the back ends. We've got to get the forehands in. Oh, my God, we didn't play on set this week. Oh, man, we got Southern Cal coming up here. We got Georgia coming up. Oh, my God, we got – and as coach, you create an environment that is not very good for learning. Number one, the clock is not a half-hour lesson, or whenever the clock is on, it's not a good environment for learning. Thomas Edison knew that all creative energy was not based on a clock. It's not a light switch. Creative energy is not a light switch that you flick on and off. It's more like a gyroscope or a semi-tractor trailer, centrifugal force builds, momentum builds into practice. And I can remember those early days, Dave Getz. If we were working on things and it wasn't right, we would start practice at 2:30, and I'd tell the manager, go on over and get us five pizzas. We're going to be here a while tonight. We got to get this right. And in just doing that, what happens is you complete your task. But we do not complete tasks. We go out to work on a backhand. We sort of got it better, but we didn't really get it better. We went out to work on competing, but, oh, guess what? We went over 4 hours, so we got to stop at 4-4 in the third, and let's play a tiebreaker. We sort of got it done, but we didn't get it done. So that's number one. Number two, and here's my point. Dave, I'm very mad at the ITA right now. I am so disgusted. I sent you a letter that I sent up there the other day. But they have done nothing to change the situation with our practices and with our matches. Now, we've had 400 teams dropped, and we've also, David, we've had, besides the 400 teams dropped, we've had no players come through and make it into pros. 20 years, when you were off the line, I said it's been since we had a woman, Lisa Raymond, go to college and end up making the top 100. In 1982, Dave, we had 39 that had gone to college on the men's side and made top 100. Today we only have one. But I'm upset that people are not speaking out, saying we're not training players. We're trying to do this hoochie-coochie show of trying to get things under 3 hours, so fan-friendly, bull crud. You know, what say you, man? What do you think?
You're right. If you want to develop players, you need the time. You need the time. If you want to do more than 4 hours a day, you need sometimes, what did Lou Holtz say? Look, we're getting 2 hours of good practice in today. I don't care if it takes 6 hours. You know, and it's the same theory that you've always had. You need the time to do it. You want to outwork people, but you can't outwork people if they don't have a time clock on them and you do. So how, I mean, the only way is to change some of those restrictions, get rid of the clock, let the guys play more matches. You can develop a lot of good players. We used to pack players in a van. We play a tournament almost every other weekend when I was a tennis coach in New Mexico. We just get in there and play. They didn't tell us you had to play 25 matches a year.
Why aren't we complaining? Why aren't we standing up and speaking out? It's so pathetic. We've had these rules since 91. And if you go back and look at the decline of college tennis, it all happened between 90 to 95. Very few players going into the pros, and the training became worse. We had an influx of professional players from other countries. All the foreign players took over the spots from the Americans. Of course, the equipment change had something to do with it. We got too player friendly, too many rules, but it all happened between 90 and 95. I mean, why isn't the ITA fighting this? I mean, I'm so upset I can't see straight, man.
I don't know the answer to that question. It seems like the ITA is promoting these rule changes, actually, not fighting them, but helping them.
Well, we got a caller on the line here, area code 347. Eric, 347-515. You'd like to talk to Dave Getz. Do you have anything to weigh in with today?
Hi, Coach Creasy. This is Rich Reyes and Quinton Monahan.
Oh, hey, good. That's awesome. We got. I don't know if you know Rich Reyes, Dave, but you know Quinton.
Yeah,
Quinton
I do.
Had a fantastic
yeah,
year
both.
This year. Yeah, Quinton yep. had a fantastic year this year up at Notre Dame. Congratulations, Quinton. Pretty darn good, but. Quinn, talk to about from the player's standpoint. Now, you went in there not knowing really what was going on. You started out and you moved all the way up the line to number two. So it had to have been a great year for you. But what are your thoughts about college tennis, and are you getting enough work done if you wanted to move on and play pro tennis?
Yeah, I think you make like a really good point that I mean the matches. I mean you play like 20. We played I think like 24 matches or something, and then obviously like to make the NCAA tournament now you have to be above 500. So then you play like 8 or 10 tours. or like even more that just kind of like you know that you're going to win, or so that you put yourself in the chance to like be in the NCAA tournament, and then so you're really only getting like 10 or so quality matches, which happen like every 2 weeks or something. But yeah, so I don't, that's not great. But then I think like practice, I'm not really sure what the like rules for individuals are, but I think like our coaches did a pretty good job of like allowing us to come in whenever we wanted, like every day for an hour and a half to work individually with one other guy to supplement the like 2.5 hour, 3 hour practices in the afternoon.
Hey, Quinn, I had a question for you.
Go ahead, Dave.
I had one quick question for you, Quinn. Give me two or three of the things that you think were the best things that you did and really helped you become, I mean, you're a high-level Division I tennis player. Give me two or three things you did that you think were invaluable that you got to do to get there that you did.
I would say the first thing was I probably, like, just committed to playing the most on the team and going in for, like, an individual 4 times a week and just, like, getting, like, some private attention. And then a second thing was just kind of, like, focusing, which coach helped me a lot with, is not, like, trying to be a college tennis player and thinking, like, broader than that. So just, like, on weekends or when we had poor matches, just like staying focused on what my priorities were and thinking past just winning a college match against like IUPUI, for example, and just having like bigger goals than that. I think those are the two main things. And then the third is just which helped was like staying on top of school, because then kind of like eases your schedule and allows you to really train. I think a lot of guys get like kind of like bogged down in like school and tests and that kind of affects their training.
Quinton, you had the great Bobby Bayless as a coach and Ryan Sachery there as an excellent assistant coach in the program. They knew the lay of the land and they knew the old school way of doing things and they could get work done. But Quinton, very, very often I see players go off to college. They come back, and they're out of shape. You would think they'd become bronze and warriors, you know, and they would become these great competitors and everything. But they come back. I say at first they're diluted with all the activities on campus, the party and the fraternities, all of those that don't share the same room. Then you get polluted by the wrong kind of things, and sometimes you get prostituted. So diluted, polluted, prostituted. I don't think college is the best training ground for top players, and unless you have a situation like you do. I'm very much against dual matches too, Quinton, for the development of players. I'm here at a Futures now in Florida, and these guys are training like crazy, and all of them have played about 3 or 4 matches. And, you know, in 1 week at a tournament, you can go to the moon. But in dual match tennis, you grow arithmetically. Like you might go 10-0 and you improve a little bit, but you fall geometrically. Tournament tennis, you grow geometrically. If you win a tournament, man, you take off. Doesn't matter, you know, what has happened before. And then what happens as well is that when you fall, you could lose 3 first rounds in a row and then pop up and win a tournament, and you're there. And so I think the dual match system has to be looked at. I just think it's very antiquated. It was good back when we could play a bunch of tournaments, Dave Gett. You know, what do you think? What do you think?
Me, I think there are certain pressures that are in a dual match situation that really do help foster player development. Number one is there's more pressure when you're playing for your team. If you're 3-all, you're the last match on that court. That's a great learning situation to be in that an individual tournament doesn't probably provide for you.
Dave, how often does that happen? Quinton, how many times are you the last guy on the court this year?
3-0. I think we played like 6 4-3s.
I know, but how many times were you the last guy on the court?
I just played one.
One. Okay, Dave, there you go. In 5 months, he gets one of those matches. One. I mean,
it's not just being the last match on, though. There's also part of it, like the whole dual match atmosphere is a –
you're pulling for your teammates, and in a big, tough dual match, if you play 10-4-3s, there's going to be a lot of huge pressure-filled moments in there when you're competing for the school and for your teammates. But you're right. The bottom line is there's not enough.
Everybody agrees that. I used to love the halftime talks. I used to think I was Bobby Knight or somebody. I could do a good halftime talk in the locker room. But I don't think tennis for participation dual matches work great to get people exposed. But for player development, definitely not, because you're always playing the person that is your level. You don't in the tournament. The first two rounds are against somebody below your level. Medium rounds, third, fourth rounds are your level, and then semis and finals usually above your level. So that's how players make jumps. But Dave, let me ask. Go ahead. You had something?
Well, no. You're obviously right, because college tennis isn't producing great players, and all the players that are coming out are playing out of the tournament format. So you're obviously right. The dual format is a great, exciting format, but you don't get enough of those moments. So I completely agree.
Yeah, we keep promoting the coach at Indiana's idea, Randy Blumenthal. He says we need to have, like Texas High School does this, 10 weeks in the fall, you do your dual matches. Yes, what you do is a Friday night and a Sunday afternoon. You go 8 weeks, that's 16 matches. You play Friday night, Sunday afternoon on your football weekends. All right, you got all those people, thousands of people there that can watch it. You can do a hoochie-coochie show. You can do any abbreviated scoring you wanted to for the team thing. You have it over by Thanksgiving. Then you do the Grand Slam of college tennis, where you do clay courts, indoors, All-American, and the NCAA tournament that is individual with satellite events around all of those, and players would go to the moon. You could have both, but it's so antiquated what we're doing right now. I got a quick question, David. Do we have cheating going on in USA college tennis? Tough question. Do we have cheating going on?
Absolutely.
Why aren't the cheaters ever caught? I got a question. I got my theory on this. Why do you think? Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I might have misinterpreted the question. I thought you meant when two guys play, one guy makes a bad line
No. Look. The reason we have cheating going on tennis court is because we have too many referees. Well, I don't know why you guys have to have six referees out there. Back in the day when you played, we didn't have referees for the first 10 years, and we never had a problem. What would happen, it would be a cold day in daggone Miami before I'd ever want Penn to leave Clemson feeling like they'd been messed over. Well, but right now with the referees, you got a lot of bad stuff. But, okay, I'm talking about the cheating that goes on in recruiting, with pro players, and all those. Is that going on?
There's some of it. Yeah, there's some of it every year. Coaches get turned in, but you also it's also a weird situation. Even a pin in the Ivy League, our athletic director came in and told everybody, you know, winning's important. If you're 6th, 7th, 8th in the Ivy League, you know, you can no longer really justify being employed at Penn. Winning's important, even at Penn, even in the Ivy League, where you might not think it would be as much. And so when it comes down to when you hear that message, and it comes down, it puts a coach in a situation where you might have to, it puts you in a tough spot. You got a more
Look, it's the deal, and I figured this out. It used to be awful. We would have little kids like Quentin Monahan. Are you shaving yet, Quentin? Have you grown some muscle?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, he goes there and he has to play these 25-year-old commando warriors, and nobody ever says anything. And the reason why is bad people don't say anything to bad people. And good people like Dave Gish, you don't want to be a snitch. We're taught in the third grade not to snitch. I think we need to call people out to their face a little bit, you know. And Dave, it's just awful. We're really underachieving. I will need to have you back on. I want to have you back on and talk about more about college tennis. I mean, we're talent's just falling through the cracks there.
Made in America. Born in a hot land. Raised up a family. A King James and Uncle Sam. He got the red, white, blue, flying high on a farm. Semper Fi tattooed on his Simpsons. Spent a little more in the store for a tag in the back of his USA. We'll be right back.
for being on. I hope you'll come on again sometime soon. And congratulations on the success you're having there with your program at University of Pennsylvania. You know, and thanks a lot, buddy. Really, really appreciate being on the show today.
Yep, thank you, Chuck.
Okay. Hey, folks, want to remind you, dive in there, man. Dive in head first. We need your opinions. We need you to fall in love to a deeper level and get in and shake it up a little bit here. Remember, squeaky wheel gets the oil. Squeaks too loud, it gets removed. Just speak up. Stand up and speak out. And listen, you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. God bless you. See you next week on American Tennis. This is Chuck Creasy.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.